Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Little Rock's Salty Dogs have released 4 albums and are currently recording their 5th. Together since 2001, the Salty Dogs have opened for Willie Nelson, Marty Stewart, Go Fast, and the Tennessee Three, among others. The neo-traditionalist band have received accolades from their peers and regional and national critics. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston CDs, Blues at Daybreak, and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Marty Ann Smith, and our featured piece is this piece right here, which is entitled Empty Street, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Marty at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Robert Bob Hupp is in his 14th season as producing artistic director of Arkansas Repertory Theater in Little Rock. Prior to assuming his position at the Rep, Robert spent 9 seasons as artistic director of the Obie Award-winning Jean Cocteau Repertory Theater in New York City, has chaired the Department of Theater at both Dickinson College and the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and has served on funding panels for the National Endowment for the Arts, the Theater Communications Group, the New Jersey State Council of the Arts, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. Bob serves as Vice President of the Board of Directors of the Theater Communications Group in New York, the national service organization for nonprofit professional theater in America. In 2012, he was named a nonprofit Executive of the Year by the Arkansas Business Publishing Group. And in the fall of 2013, he will receive the Arkansas Arts Council's Governor's Arts Award for Individual Artist. Originally from Laurel, Delaware, a town of 1900 on the Delmarva Peninsula, Bob was recently married to Clea Bunch. Together, they have 5 children, 4 of whom are currently in college. Tonight, Bob takes us to a very interesting encounter in Unearthed. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Hupp.
Towards the end of the summer of 83, during my stint as the associate tour director for the National Shakespeare Company, I was having a particularly bad day, packing up for the move back to New York City from our 3-month residency in Pennsylvania, when suddenly my assistant, Janice, grabbed my arm. Janice was a nondescript young woman, friendly enough, clearly smart, but really had no interest in theater, and seemed to be fulfilling her internship duties for reasons other than a passion for the arts. I was 24. Janice held my arm tightly, looked deep into my eyes, and said, "You know, we all have spirits that follow us throughout our lives. These spirits can come and go. Some people call them guardian angels, and they influence the choices we make in our lives. Some of these spirits try to help us. Some wish us harm. They get in our way." Now, maybe this was a great plot for a play, but in real time, this was, and she sounded, nuts. When I was 2 years old, my parents moved from Laurel, Delaware, where I was born, and returned to their West Virginia roots, where my dad accepted a job as the principal and basketball coach of Petersburg High School in Grant County, which is toward the eastern end of the state, sort of the gateway to the panhandle. Petersburg was a typical small West Virginia town, population about 2,000. It was a great place to be a little kid in the early 60s. We lived on the same street as the elementary school and the Methodist Church, and my world pretty much revolved around these two institutions. On Saturday, we would walk down to Main Street where Butch would cut my hair. We'd stop in at Mr. Bohr's drugstore for an ice cream soda, and if my folks were busy, I'd go see Miss Polly in the jewelry store, because Miss Polly always kept pixie sticks behind the counter. In third grade, as safety patrol leader, it was my job to go to the principal's office at lunchtime and turn on the town stoplight so kids could walk safely home to have lunch. After lunch, I turned it off. I don't know which was worse, that we only had one stoplight or that the town let a third grader be in charge of it. Petersburg was the scene of my first foray into the arts. When I was 5, my dad enrolled me in the Oldfield School of Gymnastics and Dance. Mr. Oldfield taught gymnastics, and on the other side of the curtain, Mrs. Oldfield taught ballet and tap. My dad thought that I was an uncoordinated kid, and that dance classes and gymnastics would help me in what I think he assumed would be my future in sports. And that clearly didn't play out the way he expected. Anyway, I was the littlest kid in the class, so I was always the top of the pyramid, the first in line, etc., etc. In 1966, we were invited to perform at the Apple Blossom Festival in Winchester, Virginia. This was my performance debut. I was a tap dancing bumblebee. At the end of the parade, as a reward for being the cutest and littlest bumblebee, Grand Marshal Lucille Ball patted me on the head. One of the perks of my dad's job was free passes to the drive-in movie, which was our primary source of family entertainment. The theory was that if the principal just made a point of making his presence known, it would reduce shenanigans and necking and the things that go on at a drive-in. About this same time, a new housing development got underway on the western edge of town, and again, another perk came my dad's way. The developers felt that they could entice folks to build in the new development if the high school principal built a home in the new neighborhood. So my dad got a pretty sweet deal to build a house on the edge of town. It was a pretty exciting move for a little kid. Besides the fact that you could see the drive-in movie screen from my new bedroom window. But I went from one street universe downtown to the woods and streams and hours of exploration afforded in those early suburban pioneers. Like everything in West Virginia, the neighborhood was carved out of shaley hillsides. Our house was the third or fourth to be built. All the other new houses had kids my age, and we spent that first summer in the new neighborhood exploring the woods, playing games, listening to the Beatles. But there was a particularly unique aspect to this new neighborhood that I didn't come to appreciate until years after the fact. Playing in and around the newly cut streets and newly dug basements, we uncovered a treasure trove of artifacts that provided no end of fascination to a boy. It turned out that the new development was being constructed on what, in the 18th century, had been a Shawnee Indian camp. I remember hearing the adults refer to the neighborhood as the fort, and our play area in the woods revolved around the earthwork remains of some frontier outpost. The rutted road leading up to the raised earth walls were almost completely obstructed by underbrush and overgrowth, but the outlines were still visible, and we spent hours playing army and cowboys and Indians in the woods in and around the remains of the fort. But the real fascination was what became known as the hunt, spent on the edges of the new, as yet unpaved roads through the neighborhood and in the newly dug, soon-to-be basements of the new homes. Here, we collected beads, arrowheads, old pots, and other artifacts. We really didn't know what they were, so we used our kids' imaginations to create new pasts for all the stuff we were digging up. We spent hours debating if this arrowhead had bloodstains, or if this particular strand of beads should be this long or that long. As kids, we just thought this is what it's like when you moved into a new neighborhood. I never recall any of our parents showing the least bit of interest in our collections or our games that increasingly centered on the cool stuff we found just lying on the overturned ground. Now, as fate would have it, after only a year living in our new house, my dad took a job as superintendent of schools in the same town in Delaware where I was born. And at the beginning of my 10th year, in 1968, we moved south and east. I knew I was going to miss my junior archaeology buddies, and as an act of extreme kid kindness, I distributed my shoebox full of treasures among my friends and moved away forever. 14 years later, I brokered the deal for the National Shakespeare Company to have its summer residency and to create its national tour on the campus of my alma mater, Dickinson College, in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I was the man on the scene and in charge of all the logistics of the residency. The college was kind enough to give me an office, just off the stage, and Janice as my intern. My job consisted then, as it does today really, of keeping the various constituencies happy and productive. At the time, the National Shakespeare Company shared the campus with the Washington Redskins summer training camp. And we were instructed to never interact with anyone who looked like a Redskin. Right off the bat, things got a little dicey when one of our costume shop employees decided to have a little fun by seating herself in the Redskin player's dining area during dinner time wearing nothing but panties and a tank top. Well, one thing led to another, and I had to dismiss our employee and give her bus fare back to New York. The dismissal of our employee set off a series of charged phone calls with the home office in New York City. I was taken aback that what I had done seemed like a grave mistake, an error in judgment. I was baffled. But then, after one particularly heated phone exchange, I got off the phone upset and worried about the future of my employment. I went outside to have a smoke. A few minutes later, Janice joined me. Out of the blue, she told me that the problem in New York City was that the girl I had fired had a boyfriend who was very influential and was a big donor to the company. I asked her how she could possibly know that, and rather matter-of-factly, she told me that she had the ability to see what other people were thinking. Okay, that sounded ridiculous. But I was 24, and this was the 80s, and this was theater. Soon after this encounter, I learned that the girl I had fired had a big deal boyfriend who was an executive with Coca-Cola and was a primary donor to the Shakespeare Company. I later met him at an artist retreat in upstate New York, where he was mowing a large field of grass on a small tractor wearing nothing but a beat-up pair of tennis shoes. But that is another story. Anyway, from this point forward, this is how my summer progressed with Janice. I'd get off a phone call. She'd tell me what was really going on with the person on the other end. Sometimes she was right, sometimes she wasn't. ESP is a helpful skill to have in an assistant. Then came the day when she grabbed my arm and told me the rather incredible story about spirits following us throughout our lives. I tried to subtly pull my arm away. She squeezed a little tighter and said, "Have you ever had an experience with Indians? Or lived with Indians or disturbed anything that might belong to them?" I felt my breath catch in my throat, but I couldn't look away. She went on, because I feel a spirit around you. It's a male. He's Native American. He blames you for something. He doesn't have your best interest at heart, and he's been with you a very long time. After that summer, I never saw Janice again. I never returned to Petersburg or heard from any of my childhood playmates. I've often wondered about them, though, and wondered if they had any pissed off Indian ghosts following them around. As for mine, well, if he's here with us tonight, I want to say I'm sorry for disturbing your things. I want to thank him for being with me all these years because, you know, there's no drama without an obstacle in this crazy, unpredictable, insecure, risky, and vastly rewarding profession. And now I want to release him to go back to his home in the hills of West Virginia. Not that I believe in that kind of thing, but this is theater after all, so just in case.
So thank you so much, Bob Hupp, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. In your story, you said that you could see the drive-in movie screen from your bedroom window. And so what movies do you remember watching?
Well, this was 1967. So what I remember, and we went all the time, this was our entertainment. I remember The Alamo, and I remember Thomasina, the Disney movie that terrified me. That cat coming back to life time and time again. That was a terrifying film. And another terrifying film was the one called The Scarecrow, also a Disney film, also terrified me. And so my parents built a house with two levels, and you could kind of, there was a kitchen on both levels, you could live on both levels. So they kind of hung out where the TV was in the lower level, and my bedroom was on the second level, all the way in the corner, by itself. And I had this image of cats coming up through the window, of these terrifying riders in the night. But then I really enjoyed the John Wayne movies. You know, those are the movies that I remembered, the Westerns, all the John Wayne pictures from the 60s were the movies that I really enjoyed. So yeah, that it was a perfect frame of that. I couldn't hear it. So I have a lot of visuals, but I have no idea what they were saying.
Were there other things that you remember seeing through your window over at the drive-in?
Not specifically. You know, there was never like this haunted sense of the neighborhood. There was, you know, as a kid, you have to have an adult tell you that something's creepy. You know, you don't think about creepy things when you can just go out and literally they'd cut through a road and you would just go through and pick up little wampum that was, you know, little beads that had been drilled through. You would pick up little shards of pottery. And it was fascinating to me that in hindsight, none of our parents said a word to us. That's why I thought, well, whenever you move into a neighborhood, you just go out and collect all the artifacts. That's what you did. So it was, we lived there for a year before my dad moved away. And can't imagine what it would have been like if we had lived there for 5 or 6 or 7 or 20 years, or what it would have been like. I mean, I would have had a whole tribe chasing after me, I guess.
Janice sounds like a very interesting person. Any other particularly insightful things that she told you? Either about yourself or someone else?
Well, okay, I'll tell you a story when she actually dropped the ball in a pretty major way. One of the productions that we were mounting that summer was Othello. And you know the story, at the end, after he's strangled his wife and he's come in and been captured, and he has this very moving monologue about his life and the significance of his life, and at the very end of the monologue, he pulls out a knife and he stabs himself. And the director didn't like the way it had been done. So as we were going into one of the final dress rehearsals, he changed the knife from a dagger to a little boot dagger. And he got a new prop and put it in the show, and it didn't rehearse. They never rehearsed it. They just went right into the show. So the actor who was playing Othello was blocked to come in, pull out his knife, and stab himself in the chest. And all the other nights, you heard kind of a hollow thump when he fake stabbed himself in the chest. Well, this night, he pulls out the boot knife, unrehearsed, and I'm sitting in the audience, and you don't hear that thump. You hear something that sounds more like a squish. And you see the actor, big guy, kind of get a look on his face. And then they did curtain call. And he did curtain call, but he hadn't moved his hand, which I thought was kind of odd. And then I went backstage, and he was lying in a pool of blood on the stage. He had stabbed himself with a real knife. They hadn't dulled the knife. It was an oversight. So I went to her after the show. I said, "What? You didn't see this coming?" I mean, you know if somebody, you know, didn't get their Coca-Cola on time, but you don't know that somebody's about to kill themselves on stage? It's a sense of proportion here. So that was our biggest, my biggest concern was that it, you know, it was sometimes a little hit and miss.
You say in your story that ESP is a helpful trait to have in an assistant. Have you had other assistants that had this trait?
Well, you know, I probably have. But here's the problem. I think if they have this trait and they're interviewing with me, then they pick up on something that just says to them, "I can't work with this guy." And what takes most assistants 6 or 9 months to figure out, they figure out like in 10 minutes and they're gone. I never see them again. And so consequently, I've never had an assistant with ESP because if they had it, they wouldn't work for me.
All right, well, we have a few minutes left here at the end for audience questions, so you can ask Bob whatever you'd like.
Having a father that was also a principal, and yours also being a coach, I'm curious what he and your mother thought about you going into the theater and acting and all of that.
You know, they were very supportive. They never knew quite what to make of it. And I mean, because I grew up in a really small town. And for me, doing theater meant going to the community theater, which was in the county seat, which is about a 45-minute drive. So they didn't know what to make of it. I remember the day I moved to New York City in 1981. It was in September of 1981. And my dad helped me move in. We drove up from Delaware I had sublet an apartment on the fifth floor of a walk-up building that didn't have a lock on the front door in what was then Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan. And so you had to step over a lot of people to move the stuff in. And then when you got into the apartment, it didn't have a toilet. There was a water closet out in the hall, and there was a bathtub by the sink. And this is what I was moving into. I paid $2.25 a month for this place in Manhattan. And we unloaded my stuff, and my dad, he just looked at me and he said, "You want to go home?" And I said, no, this is good. And he said, "Just give me a call, I'll come get you." And he got in the car and he drove back to Delaware, and they were, again, they didn't know what to make of it, but they were supportive. It's real hard to be in this business and not have a supportive family. Lots of people do it, but boy, oh boy, it's tough with a supportive family. So I was lucky that they felt good about it, and they would ask me questions and pretend like they cared. I mean, I think they did, but.
With your rich experience and history in theater, I'm just curious which one that you find more challenging to do, a play that is being premiered that's never ever been seen before, or one that already has an established history like To Kill a Mockingbird or West Side Story that already has established expectations?
Well, that's an interesting question because you mentioned the word expectations, and that's what's tough. When you do a play that people are familiar with, like To Kill a Mockingbird, or a story that people are familiar with, and you realize there are expectations and people have in their mind, they have images that may be from a film or from a particular actor, like Gregory Peck, for instance, in To Kill a Mockingbird. And so an established classic is tough. Now, when I sit down with actors, and no matter whether we're working on Shakespeare or we're working on a brand new play, one of the first things I always say to them is, we're going to treat this work as if it was written yesterday. And I hopefully have done my homework, and I understand what the artistic footprint is of a classic or a play that has a long established history, like Hamlet or Henry V or King Lear. But I think that the classics are tougher because they've been done so many ways, and it's challenging to not do something new for the sake of doing something new, but doing something that honors the text. A new play, challenging because you are forging new ground. Now, I'm going to betray my bias here, too. With very few exceptions, I haven't read a play that's been written in the last 10 years that stacks up to any play that was written 50 years ago. Now I can give you some exceptions to that. But generally speaking, you know, I prefer to direct plays that have been around for a while, and I don't direct too many new plays. Yeah, I would say it's harder to direct a play that's been around longer because of those expectations.
When you moved and you left your shoebox behind, did you trade it? Did it have a value? Do you remember who you left it to?
I do remember. Well, we all had shoeboxes. We kept stuff in the shoeboxes. And I remember vividly, I remember the toy box I kept it in downstairs. And so I would say probably five of us. It was like four boys and a girl and me, so six of us all together. And I just kind of just went into their shoeboxes and poured my stuff in there. Why did I do? I mean, what was I thinking? I could have like a wing in the Smithsonian right now if I had kept that shoebox. But no, we just kind of poured it. We took these little wampums, just those little beads, and we took a pen and, you know, cleaned out the dirt in the little hole, and then we strung them, and we wore them. And we would debate about how, you know, what the length would be. No, I didn't get anything in return. I was nicer then than I am now. I don't know. The other thing I can remember about that move, that day we moved, we had two cats, and one of the cats had just had kittens. And so we drove from West Virginia to Delaware with six cats in the car. And so I think that trumped the giving away of my beads, you know, when you got these hot cats everywhere.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Bob Hupp, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
That must be Jenica Jam, don't shake like that. That must be Jenica Jam, don't shake like that. Well, she's looking mighty fine, dancing in a cowboy hat. And she pounds her hair up high and she shimmy down low. Yeah. LeBeau, everybody. Mr. Steven Winter.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.